We continue the shiur in Gemara. We started a story, the last shiur. We'll have a very brief synopsis of the part we learned, and then continue. Story told about a man who came before Rav. Rav was the chief rabbi in Babel, and he insisted that he would hand over the property of a Jew to a goy. That's the category of a masur. Masur means one who either gives over a Jew to a goy to be killed, or gives over Jewish property to a goy. And the din is that a masur may be killed. You're allowed to kill him without a trial. In this case, this man insisted in front of Rav that he would do it, despite Rav's protests. Rav's student, Rav Kehana, was sitting there. Rav Kehana killed this man. Rav told Rav Kehana to flee to Eretz Yisrael because his life was in danger there. And in order to have this act of his forgiven, he should atone for it by spending 7 years' time in Eretz Yisrael without asking any questions of the Rosh Yeshiva there. The head of Eretz Yisrael was Rabbi Yochanan. We said to atone for what? Two opinions in it. One, that he should not have killed him, perhaps, because he could have just maimed or crippled him, not to have to take his life. Second, most of the Mefarshim insist that he had a full right to kill him, and the crime consisted of, the wrong consisted of, Rav Kehana's stating a din, a law, in front of his rabbi, penalty which is death. So Rav told Rav Kehana, in order to have this penalty forgiven, go to Eretz Yisrael and spend 7 years there to atone for this. 7 years in which you cannot ask questions. Rav Kehana arrived in Eretz Yisrael. There, Rabbi Yochanan's main student, Resh Lakish, who served as his maturigman, after a shiur, after a lesson, after a drasha, Resh Lakish would repeat the lesson over to the other students, explain it more clearly, a lighter form that all can understand it. When Rav Kehana came, he found Resh Lakish in the middle of repeating a lesson. And at every point, Rav Kehana said to Resh Lakish, "I disagree with this. I have a kushya. I have a question on it." Resh Lakish could not answer it. Rav Kehana said, "I will supply you with the answer too." He did this continually throughout the entire lesson. That evening, Resh Lakish came before Rabbi Yochanan, and he said, "A lion has come up from Bavel to Eretz Yisrael, meaning a very great Talmid Chacham. Beware, be careful of this lion in tomorrow's shiur. When you give a shiur tomorrow, he's going to attack you, he's going to embarrass you with questions you cannot answer. Therefore, prepare your lesson very carefully." Rabbi Yochanan did so. The next day, at the shiur, he placed Rav Kehana in the front row. In front of Rabbi Yochanan, there were 7 rows of students. The rule in those days, in all yeshiva, was that just as we have classes today, we have front row students, back row students. The best students sit in the front row, next to the best in the second row, and so on. The weakest students are in the rear. Rabbi Yochanan had 7 rows in front of him, and he honored this guest by placing Rav Kehana in the first row. In addition, Rabbi Yochanan sat on, as the head of the yeshiva, he sat on top of 7 pillows to show height and to show superiority, as is fit, kavod for Torah. Then he started the shiur. At each statement, he waited for Rav Kehana to question him, to attack. Rav Kehana didn't. Rav Yochanan said, "Move him to the second row, to the next row." This went on. Third time, Rav Kehana did not question him. He said, "Move him to the third row, fourth row," and so on. At the end of seven times he had not questioned, Rav Kahana was moved to the back, and this was very embarrassing for Rav Kahana. So Rav Kahana said to himself, I pray that these seven rows that I've been moved back should be a kapara, a forgiveness. They should be in place of the 7 years that I was supposed to refrain from asking questions. The seven rows that I've been moved back should be considered the yisurim, the suffering payment, in place of the suffering of 7 years of not asking questions. In other words, my act is now completely erased, and I'm free to ask questions. Rav Kahana stood up, the last row, and said to Rabbi Yochanan, may I request that you repeat the entire shi'ur once more? Rabbi Yochanan acquiesced, he agreed, and he started the shi'ur again. He finished his first statement. Rav Kahana asked the question. That was a solid question that could not be answered. Rabbi Yochanan said, move up one row. He continued. He asked the second question. Again he said, when he couldn't answer, he said, move another row. You deserve to be closer than that. This went on until Rav Kahana came to the first row. He reached the first row. And Rabbi Yochanan was old, and his eyelids were very heavy. He could not raise his eyelids. So, not that his, there's anything wrong with his eyesight, but his eyelids were so heavy that he kept his eyes closed because of that. And he had one of those who served him held a silver pair of tweezers with which he would raise Rabbi Yochanan's eyelids for him to see if ever necessary. Rabbi Yochanan said to this one who served him, raise my eyelids, I want to see what this person looks like, this Talmid Chacham, he is so great. So he raised the eyelids, and he saw through a slit, he could see Rav Kahana sitting in front of him. And Rav Kahana's lip was split. And because of that split lip, it looked like he was smiling broadly. In other words, mocking Rav Yochanan for not being able to answer his questions. In truth, of course, he was not. He sat there very respectfully. Rav Yochanan got the impression that he was mocking him. So he suddenly felt very sad, heartbroken over this. Regardless of what the reason was, regardless of how innocent Rav Kahana was, the Gemara says that hurting the feelings of a tzaddik is unpardonable. It merits the greatest penalty possible. And therefore, immediately after the shiur was over, Rav Kahana was nistalek. He passed away. Rabbi Yochanan wasn't aware of this. That night, of course, the Gemara says that one of the takanot was made was that much prior to that, many generations before, and which still exists, that in Yerushalayim, no person may be allowed, no deceased person, the person that passes away, cannot be kept overnight. A burial must be made on the same day. That's why Yerushalayim today, most burials, majority, take place at night. A person passes away during the day, they bury him immediately that same day, that same evening. Or even in the evening, the burial takes place minutes or hours after the person passes away. No other preparations are made. So here, Rav Kahana was buried immediately. Rabbi Yochanan was not aware of this. The next day, he came to the shi'ur, and he said to his student, did you see this one who came from Bavel, what he did to me? So they asked him, what did he do? He said, he was sitting there smiling at me, mocking me. So they said, Chas v'shalom, he has a split lip. It looked like he was smiling, but he wasn't. He was very serious. Yochanan said, well, where is he now? They said, he went the way of all flesh. He passed away, apparently because you felt badly, and in heaven he was punished for it. Yochanan said, I can't allow that. Show me where he's buried. Show me the cave where he's buried. They brought Rabbi Yochanan to the cave, and he saw a large serpent circling the cave. The serpent encircled the entire entrance of the cave. So he knew this serpent was sent from heaven to guard the cave, the burial place of Rav Kahana. So he spoke to this serpent and said, I know you're a messenger from heaven. Open your mouth. The serpent had his tail in his mouth, end in his mouth to complete the circle. He said, open your mouth and open up and let the rabbi come to his student. The serpent refused to open up. So Yochanan said, well, let a friend come to a friend. The serpent still refused to open up. Yochanan said, let a student enter to his rabbi. Then the serpent opened up. To show from heaven they were giving Rav Kahana such great kavod, such great honor, he was now called a rabbi. Yochanan walked in. He came to the place where Rav Kahana was buried. In those days they did not bury them in the ground. They buried them in a nick in the wall. And he prayed that Rav Kahana should come back to life. Of course, we know the Gemara says that all rabbis in the Gemara, even the smallest ones mentioned in the Gemara, had this power of Triyat HaMetim. Every rabbi mentioned in the Gemara had this power to bring a dead person back to life, especially Rabbi Yochanan, who was the head rabbi of Eretz Yisrael. He prayed and Rav Kahana came back to life. And he said to Rav Kahana, he spoke to him while he was still lying there. He said, if I would have known that this was your nature, your lip was deformed, I would never have felt sad. So this was an error, it was a mistake. Now, at least come back. Come back with us, back to the yeshiva. We need one who's that wise. Rav Kahana said, if you can pray that I should not die anymore, then I'll go. If not, I won't take a chance. Because now that I was fortunate once, I can't undertake this jeopardy once more. Rabbi Yochanan then prayed again. Rav Kahana rose up completely. He came with him. And Rabbi Yochanan asked Rav Kahana all the problems that he had, all the unanswered questions. And Rav Kahana gave him the answer to all of them. Therefore, the Gemara says that Rabbi Yochanan said many times to his students, do you think that the Torah we learn is ours? Eretz Yisrael Torah? It isn't. It's all from Bavel. Because all the deep questions we have were answered by these Chachamim from Bavel. Rav Kahana, and many times the Gemara says Rabbi Yochanan had very deep questions, deep problems, deep shaylot, he would send to Rav to get them answered. In the Yerushalmi, there's a discussion as to whether Rav Kahana came back to Rav Yochanan, or, as he said, he was afraid to take a chance, he went back to Bavel. The Yerushalmi says that he did go back with Rav Yochanan, he stayed there a while. During the time he stayed there, something else transpired. While there were people who were there were certain characters always in every group and every community who are very arrogant, very disrespectful. And one of them met Rav Kahana. This was very much publicized. Rav Kahana had passed away. He was brought back to life. He met Rav Kahana and he said to Rav Kahana, tell me, what's doing in heaven? You just came back from heaven. How about give me a report of your trip there. What's doing in heaven? Rav Kahana looked at him and said, well, in heaven it was decided that your doom is sealed. For your chutzpah, you deserve death. And this person passed away immediately. The Gemara says that a short time later, a second person came to them. They still hadn't learned the lesson. When it comes to chutzpah, it's very difficult to cure those who have this extreme disrespect. Second person came and asked him the same question, and he said, same answer. What's doing in heaven? Well, I'll report. From heaven, they decided that you're doomed. This person, too, died. Rav Kahana felt very badly, and he said, did I come to Eretz Yisrael to kill off the Jews here, Chas V'Shalom? I must go back. But I cannot go back until I receive permission from Rabbi Yochanan. Because this is a law that when a student is in the presence of his rabbi in yeshiva, he cannot leave under any conditions without permission from the rabbi. Rav Kahana knew it would be impossible to get Rabbi Yochanan grant him permission to go back to Babel, because permission to leave Eretz Yisrael, that's a hard item to permit anyone to do. According to law, a person should not leave Eretz Yisrael, even if it was a question of making a living. So he had to find some way. He decided to ask Rabbi Yochanan this law in a hidden manner, sort of a hinting at it. So he came to Rabbi Yochanan and he said to Rabbi Yochanan, I have a question. A person whose mother hates him, treats him very badly, that's his original mother. And then his stepmother, that is his father, had divorced his mother, he had remarried. His stepmother treated him very nicely, respectfully, with honor. Which one should he go to? To his mother, who despises him, who treats him badly, or to his stepmother, who treats him very well? Yochanan said, the new wife of his father is the one he should go to. He should go where he is treated nicely. And Rav Kahana took that. He left. Yochanan later asked, where is Rav Kahana? And they said, he went back to Babel. Yochanan said, impossible. How could he leave without permission? The student said, he did ask permission. He asked you a question in which he received your permission, because he said, if his mother dislikes him, Eretz Yisrael, that's the land that's his mother. That's the motherland of the Jews. But he found that he was being very maltreated in Eretz Yisrael. He couldn't get along. He was being harmed. His feelings of being hurt continually was causing a lot of damage. Whereas in Bavel, that's Galut. The Shekhinah is in Galut there. It's like a second wife. There, he receives a great deal of honor. Everyone respects him there. And he asked, where should he go? You told him to go to the wife of the second wife of your father. So he did that. That's why he went to Baba. In this story, we have a number of important lessons, a number of important halachot, dinim. And this is why there's a question brought in Yerushalmi. It's brought also in Halacha, Shulchan Aruch. As far as learning Agadah, Agadah means stories of the Gemara. Learning Agadah, of course, is very vital. It's a vital part of the Torah, because a person can never be aroused, inspired to mitzvot, to love for Torah and mitzvot as much as he could through any other learning except Agadah. Learning stories of tzaddikim, rabbis of the Gemara, can inspire a person to the highest levels in serving Hashem through Ahava. Same time, the question there is brought, can we ever learn a halacha, a din, from Agadah? And there are many poskim who say, ein lemedim in ha-agadot. You cannot learn any dinim from Agadot. Even if you find a din, Agadah is, the stories of Gemara are not made to learn dinim from. Others say, definitely they are made to learn dinim from, because they are as much part of Gemara Torah as any halacha, any pilpul in the Torah. This is the opinion of all the great tzaddikim, Balei Kabbalah. Especially in this case where we learn simple dinim of midot, character, quality and character, about how a Jew should conduct himself in respect to Torah, looking up to these great tzaddikim, and having emunah and the greatness of the Chazal, Chachamenu Zal, our rabbis of the Gemara, how great and how holy they were, that their words were law in heaven. A tzaddik said a word, and all of heaven leaped to fulfill his word. How particular heaven, meaning Hashem, is of the feelings of a tzaddik. And that's why we find in the Pirkei Avot, where it says, beware of these Talmidei Chachamim, because their words are like coals of fire. How careful one should be to be on the good side of these tzaddikim, how much infinite reward he gets by finding favor in their eyes, how they can lead him on the right track throughout life, on the path that leads to Olam Haba, rather than to Chas V'Shalom antagonize them, and to find life here closed, as well as life in the future, Chas V'Shalom. So in this story we find too how these Talmidei Chachamim had this mutual respect for each other, how deep their respect was one for another. And this is what Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai Zal said to his students. Rabbi Akiva had 24,000 students who were all great tzaddikim. They were all perfect, pure tzaddikim, never committed a sin in their lives. And yet a plague descended from heaven and wiped them all out, only because they were not friendly to each other. Later, when these 24,000 passed away, Rabbi Akiva acquired 5 new students. One of these was Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai Zal. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai Zal in turn had 6 major students. He had 9 top ones, but 3 passed away. And then he had 6 left. These were called the menorah. The central candle of the menorah burned straight upwards. The other 6 burned on a slant towards the center. Shimon Yochai Zal was called the Shabbat, and the 6 days of the week which received their light, the Shefa, from the Shabbat. So there Rabbi Shimon Yochai Zal said to his students, we are different than the students of Rabbi Akiva. You will succeed. You will live long, and you will spread the light of Torah, especially the hidden light of Torah, the Kabbalah, to all Jews in the future. This is the generation of the highest revelation in all of history. And that's because Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai Zal told them that their motto was Anan b'chaviva b'chavivuta talya milta. We, our future and our greatness depends upon the mutual ahava amongst ourselves. He taught this deep ahava to them, and he taught the lesson in the future that there should always be this ahava, mutual respect among Talmidei Chachamim, among friends, among rabbis and students. Always the Ahava is what keeps them alive, what makes them, leads them to success in Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba. The Gemara says that when a person gets married, the marriage requires a contract. This marriage contract is called a ketubah or a ksuva. This ketubah is a contract in which the groom or the husband states that if at any time in the future there is a separation, either because of the death of the husband or because of a divorce, the husband divorces the wife, then the wife will be taken care of either by receiving a stipulated sum, a sum of money for a settlement, or she will continue to be supported as during the lifetime of the husband by the children. In most cases, of course, it's the stipulated sum that's stressed mainly, and this sum is a sum total of $200 in a ketubah. This is the law. By law, this must be stated in the ketubah. In addition, we have the Tosafot ketubah. That means the additional amount that is not compulsory. Every bridegroom could add to the amount as much as he pleases, much as he wants to. This Tosafot ketubah could be twice as much as the original amount, the original legal amount, which means instead of 200, he could have 400. Or he could place an arbitrary sum of even $5,000 additional, or even still more. For example, it's the custom of the Sfaradim to add $5,555, because they consider fives a lucky number, so they go wild with these fives. But this is a number that is not compulsory. There's no set amount. Now, once the woman is divorced or she is widowed, she collects this amount immediately from the property of the husband. Any money that's left over for inheritance, first payment must go to the wife for this $200 of a ketubah or any additional amount. Now, this contract, what's the main purpose of this contract? The Gemara says the main reason is that if not for this contract, the moment that a man would find himself displeased with his wife, she'd make him angry in the slightest, he would divorce her immediately. But if he would stop to think that the divorce has to cost him money, as an expense, $200 plus whatever amount he wrote in it, he'll think twice, he'll be very careful, and he'll control his anger and decide that it's not worth it. Some wives, of course, they would pay more than that to dispose of them, but in most cases, the husband doesn't have that much cash on hand, so it does help, in many cases, to avoid the sudden divorce. Spontaneous divorce because of sudden anger, this is the main purpose of the ketubah. Now, for this reason, the din says that there must always be a ketubah present between husband and wife. The time of the wedding, the husband must give the wife this ketubah, and she is supposed to keep it throughout her entire life. If the ketubah is lost or destroyed in a fire by accident, the husband and wife cannot live together. They cannot be together until a ketubah de ichasa is written. It means a duplicate ketubah for one that was lost. But there must be a ketubah present at all times to legalize the husband and wife being together. And this is why we stress this, because among the Sfaradim, very sadly, sad to say, that the custom there is, many cases, not all of course, that at the time of the marriage, the bridegroom gives the bride the ketubah, and she in turn gives it to her mother for safekeeping, and then it's forgotten about. Now, at that time it might be safe, right or wrong, it's at least safe, but they forget about it. It's inadvertently, this thing is completely forgotten about. The husband and wife could move off to a different city, or a different country even, or after years, the parents could pass away, and the ketubah is lost, and not having seen the ketubah, not having had it all this time, they forget about the fact they have to have one. Here you can have a mechshol, a trap, where a husband and wife could be living together without a ketubah at all, chas v'shalom, because of this erroneous custom of giving the ketubah to the mother-in-law for safekeeping. In addition, I would state very emphatically that it's very questionable as to whether it's permissible to give the ketubah for safekeeping to the mother-in-law, even for a short period. Because this means that the ketubah is taken out of the property, out of the home of the husband and wife, it's in someone else's home. This too is not actually legal. It must be under the ownership and the property of the husband and wife at all times. So this is a din that's worthwhile, worthy of considering, thinking about, and correcting those cases where this din is not being conformed with. It's a very serious item. The Gemara says this was the Gzeira of Rabbi Meir. And Halachak Rabbi Meir b'Gzeirotav. The law remains like Rabbi Meir in his decrees. This was one of his decrees. This law is agreed to by all rabbis. The Gemara says there is a chok. A chok means a law where the reason for it is not revealed in the Torah. Reason is known only to Hashem. Or in some cases the Gemara says Hashem revealed it to Moshe Rabbeinu, but no further than that. For example, the din of Para Aduma, the red cow, burning of the red cow, and the ashes of the red cow are used to purify a person who's Tameh. There it says that Shlomo HaMelech, the wisest man of all men, struggled many years to try to find the reason to this law, and he could not. Only Moshe Rabbeinu received this information. These laws are called a chuk, a law where Hashem did not reveal the reason, and Hashem said, despite the fact you don't understand it, despite the fact that you will have criticism by others, by disbelievers, or by goyim, as to why you obey this law, you still must obey it. Your reason should be sufficient. Reason is that Hashem commanded it. That's enough reason to obey it. For example, we have the law of mixtures, forbidden mixtures. You have the chok of milk and meat, where you have two positives, pure kosher items. You get the most kosher meat, glatt kosher. In itself, it could be eaten by the most religious person in the world. You have also in itself a separate unit, milk, kosher milk, Chalav Yisrael, observed by a Jew when the cow was milked. It's 100% kosher in all respects. If you take these two positives, these two pure kosher items, and mix them, they become one negative item. An item that is so tarif, much worse than even pig's meat, because you cannot even give this to a dog. You cannot give this away. You cannot have any pleasure from this at all. It's not only asur to eat, but it's also asur, forbidden to have any pleasure from it. This is one forbidden mixture. And we have a forbidden mixture in clothing, a combination of wool and linen. This too, two pure items. Wool is perfectly pure. Linen is perfectly pure, can be used for anything, and yet to combine these two is considered a forbidden mixture. This is called kilayim, or shatnez. Shatnez, kilayim means a forbidden mixture, and kilayim and begadim in clothes is called shatnez. And this shatnez is forbidden. Again, the law is not, the reason for the law is not known, though there are suggestions made. Well, we cannot understand even the reason for these suggestions. For example, the Zohar Kadosh hints at the fact that there were two, first two people born in the world could not get along. They could not merge together in harmony, Cain and Hevel, and what brought about, the last straw that brought about the destruction between the two, the death of Hevel, was the fact that both brought a korban to Hashem. The korban of Hevel was accepted. Hevel's korban was the shorn wool of his sheep. That's wool. And Cain brought that which grew from the ground, flax, linen. This was rejected, and this resulted in an act of murder. Therefore, it's logical that these two should not be mixed together. This is a statement said in the Zohar Kadosh as a hint at it, but of course it is still maintained that the actual reason for shatnez is not revealed to us. That's called kilayim of begadim of clothes. The topic the Gemara speaks about here is kilay behema. You cannot mix two animals to have them both serve you simultaneously. For example, if you have a wagon, a coach, you have horses who are pulling this coach. You cannot hitch onto the wagon a cow and a horse, two different types of animals, because this is called kilayim. This mixture is just as forbidden as milk and meat, or as forbidden as wool and linen and clothes. So no two animals could be tied onto a wagon. The Gemara says even if one animal is in the rear, where it's not helping to pull the wagon, it's just tied onto the wagon, that too is forbidden. To have a cow and a mule, or any two different types of animals tied to the same wagon, this is forbidden. Then the Gemara says, the Gemara asks a unique question. What if a person has a wagon, like a trotter's wagon, and he attaches to this wagon in order to get speed from it? He has a goat. Goat runs quickly, and he rides his wagon right along the seashore, right near the sea. He has a trained fish, a dolphin, who is trained, a very fast swimmer. He attaches a rope from the wagon on one side to the goat, the second side to this dolphin. The dolphin swims parallel to the goat, parallel to the shore. Now these two, the goat and the fish, both drag or pull along this wagon. Is that considered kilayim, since a fish is not in the same family as an animal? Two different types completely. Can we say that there is kilayim, a forbidden mixture between animal and fish? We do not find this law in the Torah. The Gemara asks, what would be the law of this case? The Gemara says, that case, if this would be forbidden, then you would have to say also that a person who plants, there is also a law forbidding a person to plant two types of seeds in proximity to each other, very close to each other. You can't plant wheat and oats right next to each other. What if a person plants wheat right at the border of Eretz Yisrael? This law of kilayim, the fields, kilay zera'im, it's called seeds, mixture of seeds, this law applies only in Eretz Yisrael. The other laws apply outside of Eretz Yisrael too. But this law, since it applies to Eretz Yisrael only, you're allowed to plant mixtures of seeds in Chutz La'aretz, in a Torah. Now what if a person plants a seed of wheat right at the border, and literally next to it, adjacent to it, but just on the other side of the border, an inch away, he plants oats? Would you say, if you say that it's forbidden to mix animals and fish, you have also two separate types, you would have to say that Eretz Yisrael and Chutz La'aretz would be also forbidden to have these two, since they're planted next to each other? Jimenez says there's definitely no comparison, because here, in comparing these seeds, the two seeds, you have one which is in a place, locality, where it could become forbidden. If you'd have a second, different type of seed next to it, this wheat seed would become forbidden. So that the one outside is completely divorced from this law. It's in a place where it could never become forbidden. So that you cannot unite, combine these two, where one is always permissible and one is always forbidden. Whereas in the case of an animal and a fish, both could be forbidden. Because, for example, if a person would have a rowboat, a small boat, and he would attach two fish to this boat to pull, and he had two different types of fish, this would definitely go into the category of kilayim. If you have two kinds of fish, let's say a shark and a whale, to pull your boat, to pull your ocean liner, then you'd be breaking the law of kilayim as far as living beings are concerned. So since the law of kilayim applies to both of these species separately, therefore it is possible, we could say that in this case a goat and a fish combined together, since both could be part of isur, therefore when they're together they're considered also as kilayim. So the maskana, the final decision of the Gemara, is that it is forbidden for a person to attach an animal and a fish to a wagon, just as it is forbidden to attach two animals or two fish. Although this is an unusual case, a very rare occasion to see this, yet we still have to know the din. The Gemara applies dinim even to cases that are so rare they might happen once in a lifetime, or perhaps not even an entire lifetime. We still must have knowledge of these laws, and the reason being that we find many cases when we have a din that we say could never occur, and yet by having the knowledge of this law, we can always apply it to a different case that does occur often. You must, of course, know how to apply these laws, but having a knowledge of all these laws can help you in solving many problems. In most cases, when a shayla comes up, question of kasher, question of isur and heter, forbidden and permissible, there are many times when you cannot find this law in the Gemara or Shulchan Aruch. A person will be stumped, and therefore he has to have a wide knowledge of Gemara and Shulchan Aruch to know exactly where to compare to something similar, a similar item, a similar case in the Gemara and Shulchan Aruch, and thereby solve this problem. That's why every one of these cases too must be known clearly, so that it could affect a solution to problems that come up in daily life. Yemena says that Ravina, who was one of the last rabbis of the Yemena, came to a city, and there, since he was one of the chief rabbis at that time, wherever he came, he would collect money for tzedakah, for charity. He came to this city, Be'mechuza. The women came out to greet him. They had like a lady's auxiliary, which works hard in raising funds for charity. These women got together, and for an appeal, they brought him expensive jewelry. Brought him some of their jewels and contributed this to this appeal. And Ravina accepted this charity. One of Ravina's friends, Rabbi Tosfah, asked Ravina, "How can you allow yourself to accept this money from these women?" The Yemena says very clearly that it is forbidden for a gabbai tzedakah, a charity collector, to collect money from women, because a woman has no money of her own. Whatever a woman has belongs to her husband, so that she has no right to squander her husband's money even for tzedakah. It's not hers. She has no permission to do so unless he explicitly allows her to give this money to contribute to charity. Except, the Gemara says, a small amount, then we take for granted that a husband would allow his wife to give a small amount. She doesn't have to ask him. So a person comes in for charity, she gives him a few coins or a dollar or so. She doesn't need permission of her husband, and the person accepting, taking this money may accept it. It's not considered stealing from her husband. But that's only small amounts. How come you accepted so valuable, so expensive gifts as you took from these women in Beit Mechuza? This wasn't single dollars. This wasn't small amounts. This was jewelry, very expensive jewelry. Ravina replied that I still followed the law. The din says that you are allowed to take from women a small amount, which means something inexpensive could be taken from a woman without having to receive permission from the husband. Now, what do we consider a small amount? How much is small? A person's wealth consists of $1, that's all he has to his name, then 50 cents is a very large amount. That's half of his wealth. A person has $1,000, 50 cents is no money at all. A person has $1,000,000, and of course, even $100 is no money at all. So this law is very relative. It depends on each individual. A small amount does not mean to say just a dollar or a few coins. It means small in ratio to the wealth of the person. Well, in this city, Beit Mechuza, the people here are so wealthy that when these women give their jewelries, just simple trinkets as far as they're concerned, they are so wealthy that this is small money compared to the earning capacity, compared to the wealth of their husbands. So though it appears to be a very expensive item, a heavy amount, yet for these people's wealth, this is considered a small amount, and therefore I am legally justified in accepting this. And of course, this din is one that women have to be very careful about. Women in general have very good hearts. They are softer touches as far as charity is concerned. In case of a needy person, they give much more freely. But they have to know they are bound by this law not to give too much beyond the limit that would satisfy their husband. So if they want to give a large amount, they must receive direct permission from the husband. Otherwise, small amounts they may contribute without notifying the husband at all. This is the law of tzedakah in reference to women. And in general, the mitzvah of tzedakah is so important that it is given to women too. Because this is the one mitzvah where a person can correct his misdeeds. Tzedakah erases sins. Tzedakah is something that could ensure a person's future in this world and in Olam Haba. We should be zochet to this important mitzvah. We should be zochet through this mitzvah to see the redemption.